Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 16 of the Ball 5 podcast, the podcast that will not admit any wrongdoing but will still begrudgingly serve their 10-game suspension. My name is DJ Lopes. I'm one of your hosts, and joined with me is my brother Chris Lopes. Chris, on attempt 3 of that joke, did it still hit as good as it would have if I nailed it on attempt 1?
I swear on my children that it was fine.
I'll take it. How you doing?
See, and my joke didn't even land there, too, so... whatever.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm rolling. Feel like the Mets are doing good this, even though, well, date ourselves on this Sunday night. The Mets actually not playing bad right now in this San Francisco game, but feel like we have had a good West Coast trip so far.
Yeah, and we will definitely get into that later. Hopefully by the time that we get to the Mets, you know, probably like 35, 40 minutes into this podcast, we will have a better idea as to the result of this game. But as of recording right now, at least on my stream, there is one out in the top of the seventh inning in a 4-4 game, and Francisco Lindor is facing John Brebbia. But enough about that. This is an episode that, you know, I don't want to say that I'm not excited to record our podcast. I think it's more just that I get the anxiety of having to do work in relation to this podcast before recording. But this podcast, heading into it, just with some of the stories that have been coming out, actually had me like pretty excited, and I was ready to go in some of the things that I wanted to say. So without further ado, we'll just get into it. We'll get into our system, our segment that we have begrudgingly in the first called favorite thing, least favorite thing, surprise. But now we are debuting at least a new temp title that Chris himself came up with after just a lot of thought, a lot of potentially nixing other more popular podcast names. Chris, what is the new name, at least for now, of our favorite, least favorite surprise segment?
I'll give Allie a lot of credit on this one as well. But
shout out to Allie.
We're going to go with a triple play.
There we go. It is indeed a baseball play that involves things in threes. I was trying to think of like maybe it's like the progression of a triple play where you get the first out and you're like, oh, cool. And then you get the second out and you're like, oh, and then you get the third and it's a surprise. But there's nothing really bad in that, I guess, unless you're watching it. On the other hand, you're watching your team hit into a triple play. But regardless,
yeah, it's really a hard one.
Regardless, I think it works fine, at least for now. So I will start off because the last time I let you go ahead of me, you sniped my Zach Neto debut surprise. And I'm going to say that my good thing, and this could have some consternation as to how good a thing is because of, you know, the ways he's been in the news recently, but my good thing is that Fernando Tatis Jr. is back to playing baseball in MLB. He made his debut over the weekend against the Arizona Diamondbacks, has struggled a little bit in coming back. I believe now he is 3-for-18, so still not really hitting his stride, definitely not at the levels he was hitting at when he was in AAA, and he had like 6 home runs in 7 games. So he's not quite there, but he's getting into it, and he's playing right field, hasn't been too terrible there. And I know that at this point, with what his reputation is and what's happened in the last year, all the stories that have came out about his attitude and you know, the things that he's done that led to his injury, as well as the steroid suspension, it feels like public opinion has kind of soured a little bit on Fernando Tatis Jr., and in some respects, rightfully so. You know, I think that when you have a steroid suspension, whether deserved or not, it is going to impact your reputation. But I think in this time being, it's kind of made a lot of people forget just how electric and good for the sport of baseball a guy like Fernando Tatis Jr. is. So, yeah, I think regardless of how much he struggled to start, I think overall it's just a good thing for baseball that he is back playing now right field for the San Diego Padres.
Yeah, that's definitely where it is. It's definitely an up and down thing. You know, I think that the people having the criticism saying that we shouldn't be celebrating someone coming back from a PED injury, a PED suspension, and also, you know, the dumb injuries that he's had, I think that they have their rights to say that. You know, I know that it's very much the old man on the lawn type of take, but I do believe that there is some merit to those takes. But I also do believe in the take that you're saying too, you know, especially if we just let the young kid, you know, make those mistakes and, you know, hopefully learn from them. You know, I obviously, when you make a mistake, the whole goal afterwards is to show that you've learned from it, you know, so hoping that he shows that he's learned from those mistakes. And, you know, I think the biggest thing, and I don't think it can be understated. Now, granted, this was kind of the case in the past few years, especially with, you know, Machado and him being there the whole time, Soto coming along last year. But now with Bogaerts here, too, I honestly think the pressure is really off of Fernando, you know. So he doesn't have to feel, I don't know if this was what led him to go down the road of steroids and all that stuff, but he doesn't have to feel the pressure of being kind of the guy in San Diego, you know. He can stand to kind of trade that off between Soto or Machado or Bogaerts or something, and they can kind of bounce that title around. But then also he can still, you know, be that electric self. Be the person that helps, you know, bring baseball into the front of everything, I guess, you know, and make it, you know, energetic and stuff like that. So hoping that he's learned from everything, basically.
Well, we know it wasn't the pressure of trying to be great. It was the ringworm that led to him.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
That is still, I want to revisit that at some point. That is still one of the craziest stories I've ever heard. That he got popped for PEDs and was like, no, this was ringworm. And then everybody looked up the thing you get for ringworm, and it was similar to the drug he took, but not the exact same thing. And it was just this whole entire thing. And then they found out, I think some doctors found out that that's the drug you want to take if you want your ringworm to get worse. It was a whole thing. But yeah, so I think that as far as from a purely baseball perspective, you know, just looking at this lineup now, we had the whole thing with the first time it happened where Tatis got together, you know, Soto trade happened. And then right before Tatis got popped, there was this whole talk about, you know, this lineup, who's going to get anybody in this lineup out, especially with Josh Bell being added, Brandon Drury being added at the deadline. And then you get to it and you realize that now it's even better. Because now you've replaced Josh Bell with Xander Bogaerts. And from a baseball perspective, I don't see when all of these people get going. And I know that Soto has had his struggles as well. Tatis, obviously, as we mentioned, started off with the struggles. But I just don't see how this top four is remotely possible to get out when they all get going.
Yep, exactly. I really don't see it. So,
yeah, so I think that just about does it for my good. Chris, do you want to get going with your good?
All right, DJ, I told you earlier that I was gonna throw you for a loop today with my good, bad, and ugly. Okay.
Right.
Or good, bad, surprising, whatever the hell we call it.
Your triple
or
the play. Triple play. You came up with
my
the
triple
name.
Play. I told you I was gonna throw you for a loop. I am gonna give my best New York Times op-ed and why that the Oakland Athletics news is a good thing. So here is my take on this, all right? And again, this is going to be my New York Times op-ed thing. And we all know that that sometimes is a little wishy-washy and stuff. I think this is really frustrating for baseball, obviously. It's really frustrating for the Oakland A's fans. They do not deserve this. They've been a good fan base for a while. And to see an owner take such advantage of a fan base is disgusting and immoral and stupid, you know? But hey, at the very least, these Oakland fans can say, screw this dude, and then at least watch the San Francisco Giants. So at least there is a relatively close team that they can be fans of. They don't have to stick with the A's because fuck that guy, you know? And what I really do think that it's going to kind of put the domino down is for other kind of really bad owners to search for new locations. And yes, maybe we're screwing over fans, but there are certain teams where I think could really stand to kind of be better served to move. You know, they talk a lot about the Tampa Bay Rays going to Nashville. Now I think that that could potentially be the domino that kind of falls for that. I think you got, you know, the Castellinis and the Reds over there. I think that there's, even though the Cincinnati fans, it's the same situation. Cincinnati fans do not deserve what's going on in Cincinnati. especially since, you know, they had competed, and then you kind of just shit all over it, you know, by trading everyone away. So, you know, I just think that there are opportunities now where teams can kind of realign, teams can kind of move around, and Oakland fans honestly can go root for someone that cares about them a little bit more now. I told you it was going to be the New York Times op-ed, so.
Okay, at least the segues into my bad, which was the Oakland A's potentially moving to Las Vegas.
The only other thing I do want to note is that I did mention those three teams, the Rays, the Reds, and the Oakland A's and their fans. I purposely left out the Tampa Bay Rays fans because I really don't think that they exist. I don't know that anyone is actually a fan of the Tampa Bay Rays. And isn't their stadium like an hour out of Tampa or something?
Yeah, the reason that they get really low, you know, fan turnout despite having a consistently great team is, I mean, A, the fact that the Stars aren't that marketable. Now it's changing a little bit, but in general they're not all that marketable, but also just the fact that it is nearly impossible to get to from where anybody lives in Tampa. But yeah, I will say that this cycles into my bad, because once again, we mentioned it last week that just the way that the A's have been ran as an organization is just the textbook way to, I don't know, I, you know, A, piss off fans, and B, just, I just don't, and I know that you did your whole New York Times op-ed there, but I just don't necessarily see how there is a good spin of what's gone on there, regardless of if it motivates other people to look for nicer locations or if it goes to expansion. I don't think that the fans deserve that in Oakland. I have seen people, the Oakland, I believe they're called the Oakland 68s, the troop of people that play drums at every Oakland A's game. They have announced that they are canceling their season tickets, I believe, and they are, you know, they went in and got all their drums from the storage space in Oakland. And it's just, it's a bad ballpark that they have had no interest in renovating or putting any resources into at all. And they have led to this whole spat with local governments and local authorities over who should pay, who should foot most of the bill for their new ballpark in Oakland, which is the whole reason this even happened, is that John J. Fisher, the coward that he is, wanted taxpayers to foot the bill for this new stadium rather than, you know, billionaire John J. Fisher. So I just think that it's been a bad thing on the fans, and I listened to a little bit of Effectively Wild, and Meg Rowley had a great point that's just like, eventually the politicians have to say, you know, this is not something we're going to let you kind of boss us around for. And if we have to look at what we as a society gain from not having you guys around, it sucks that we have to let you guys go, but also we have to look out for our constituents and the people that actually live in Oakland rather than John J. Fisher in his pockets. So I think that in all totality, it is a sad thing what has been happening to the Oakland A's, and something that should be studied to be avoided in the future. As to what's happened with this franchise, just how quickly they've tore everything down. They were a playoff team 2 years ago, or at least a playoff team 3 years ago, a playoff caliber team 2 years ago, and now are one of the least competitive teams in maybe soon to be the history of baseball, as well as just a poorly run team that is trying to lose, trying to draw down interest in the organization, and from fans that, once again, do not deserve that. So I know that you had your, the Oakland A's moving is good, actually, but I'm not going to say I'm not willing to hear arguments to the other end, but I just believe that the bad in this so much so outweighs the good. And just, you know, playing out, I just want to say that John J. Fisher is an absolute coward of a human being and should not be allowed the opportunity to get this, level of, you know, successful things happening in his career, of getting to move to Las Vegas, because at the end of the day, that's exactly what he wants, and he's going to get exactly what he wants. He will continue to get exactly what he wants, and the big thing is that I don't know what the A's are going to do in the interim, because nobody's going to go to these games. The plot of land that they have to build the stadium on, stadium's not going to be ready until like 2027. So they have a good four years that they're going to have to survive with absolutely nobody being interested, because they know they're going to leave, and nothing in sight for a competitive ball team. So I think you are going to see all-time lows of, you're going to see all-time lows of attendance, of competitive baseball, of entertainment, and all in all, they are going to try to find a way to get out there as soon as possible.
I'm going to just go right out with it. My bad is also the Oakland A's moving as well.
Okay, at least you redeemed yourself there.
Got you there, DJ. No, honestly, when I say all that the good stuff, quote unquote, ultimately, it, like you're saying, none of it outweighs, and even the good stuff is very tongue in cheek. Like, well, hey, if this guy doesn't want to be with you, then fuck it, don't care for this team, I think that the bad on this one is exactly everything that you said. The treatment of the fans has been absolutely insane. You still have some diehards that go there. And why would anyone go to an Oakland A's game? You're watching a not a great product. You're watching it in a stadium that is really hard to watch baseball in just because of how crappy it is and everything. And what's really, really, really bad is, as you're saying, when Oakland was footing competitive teams, it kind of still, though, was a little reminiscent of what, this baseball team wanted to do in the end. It was get the best team out there for the cheapest amount of money. And then they realized, well, fuck, how about we don't even try to win and we still just get the cheapest team and make profit? So it kind of sucks that even their success kind of led to this type of thinking. I think recently a video showed of like people, there was a thread of people showing their favorite Oakland Athletics moments, and it was a Grant Balfour moment going out in the was it the ALDS or ALCS or something, and it was just insane. It was electric. He walked out to Metallica, everyone's headbanging in the stadium, everyone's going fucking crazy in the stadium, and it was just such a cool environment. And to be able to not see that type of thing anymore, in really nice uniforms too, but to not be able to see that type of stuff, it's just, again, it's just a really shitty, it's shitty for the players, because they have nothing to play for. They don't really care at all. I think the only thing for them to play for right now would be, the major league style, fuck this dude, let's just go out and win, but I don't even think they can do that. They're at a historically terrible run differential right now that's like outpacing the worst run differential in the history of the game by like 500 runs or something like that. Like, this is unprecedentedly bad, and it's unprecedentedly bad because of the shittiness and, like you said, the cowardice of their owner. And you feel for the fans, you feel for the players, and you just feel for everyone that's getting fucked over by this dude. So my bad, as well as my good, but mostly my bad, is the Oakland Athletics.
Yeah, and you mentioned the thing about the players, and basically just what it is now, veterans are, their motivation is to play well so that they can go to a better team, they can get traded to a better team, but also I feel like the young guys are probably just going to play because this is A, their dream, and B, their job. So
this is their job, yeah.
It feels like now that they are going to end up playing more as an obligation than it is as a passion. And that's just not what you want. That's not how baseball was ever meant to be enjoyed. And even when you get to the people that are making, money hand over fist, I don't want to necessarily say that because whatever the players make, the owners make 10 times that. These players that are making a lot of money still don't really ever lose sight of that. And they do play with that passion and that energy that you want to see. So I don't know. It's just a terrible situation all around. And once again, it's hard to have this conversation without getting to the fact that this is just what capitalism is.
Yeah. What it is.
If something is proving to not be as profitable as you want, even if it's not profitable because of your own doing, you have to try to look elsewhere and in turn fuck over anybody that has ever supported you and anybody that has ever created anything for you. And I don't know. I know that baseball is played in Las Vegas, and I know that baseball is played in a lot of very hot climates, but I just don't see how baseball, I mean, like summer sports in general that are outdoor, are very conducive to being played in Las Vegas. Because, sure, there's the WNBA and the Las Vegas Aces, but that gets to be played indoors. There's NBA Summer League that gets to be played indoors. It's just, and once again, like I said, I know that there are teams that play in Vegas, but I don't know. It just doesn't seem too viable. It doesn't seem like it'd be too fun. It seems like you're just playing into tourists, and you're not really going to have a diehard fan base, which, while they didn't show up a lot, they only didn't show up in Oakland because you didn't want them to show up. Yeah. But Oakland has
again,
a...
Why would they go?
Yes.
You know?
Oakland has a diehard fan base is what I'm getting at. And you're just... You cannot... It takes a while to grow a diehard fan base in any sport, but it feels impossible to grow a diehard fan base in Vegas because all you're really going for with the move to Vegas is to get tourists that are there in the summer for a vacation and in the middle of hitting the casinos want something to do either before they go there or in the morning or, I mean, you know, in the afternoon so they go to a baseball game. I don't know. It's just a horrible situation. John J. Fisher, I don't know. Basically, that's the whole long and short of it. It's just terrible, and we'll probably never have to speak about the A's again. I said that last week, but now I really feel like we probably won't have to speak about the A's again, and it is indeed, once again, just sad. But, you know, enough about that. We now have our surprise, and since I went first on the good and the bad, I'll let you have the surprise.
Well, DJ, get ready, because my surprise is the Oakland Athletics, baby. I will say that the biggest thing where my and yes, you're gonna have to talk about it for the next 10 minutes here. My biggest surprise with this whole thing is that we knew this was coming. So it's not a surprise from that state. We knew that this was coming. I do think that the timing of this is insane. As you mentioned, they still have to play in Oakland for probably the next 4 years. Either that, or they're going to have to find some interim solution in Las Vegas, which what that might be playing in the Aviators, the AAA for them. That doesn't make any sense. They're not going to be able to do that. And also, it's a historically insane fucking run environment in that situation. So there's no way that they're going to play in the Las Vegas Aviators stadium. So they can't do that. I doubt that they're going to change the Las Vegas, is it the, I'm being an idiot here, is it the Las Vegas Raiders?
Yeah, the Raiders, right?
Yeah, so I doubt that they're going to, you know, retrofit that stadium to play baseball for a few years there. I don't see how they can play in Oakland, though, because one, I don't know that that stadium can last another 4 years. Two, I don't know how you're going to make any money, and obviously that doesn't matter that much, but I don't know how you can field anything to get on that thing. So they're gonna just, you know, further compound. It just feels like a wild thing, and I don't know how else you do this. I don't know how close you can keep this to the chest before, you know, then you say, hey, next year we're moving. You know, you obviously can't do that because it'd be really fucking hard to build a stadium in the middle of nowhere. Right on the Las Vegas Strip, sorry, the middle of everywhere. You know, so it would be really, really difficult to do all that. But I just don't know how they're going to be okay doing this, you know? And that's kind of why I'm surprised by it, you know? I'm surprised that it just happened the way that it did. You know, and I'm also surprised that there hasn't been more movement on, like I said, you know, the Rays moving to Nashville or the Rays moving to Montreal or something like that. So,
yeah. And one thing that I wanted to get to a little earlier on the A's thing is that it's just been, in general for the fans, the A's were like their last thing to hold on to because, as you mentioned, the Raiders moved from Oakland to Las Vegas and it's slightly smaller, but these Golden State Warriors moved from the Oracle Arena, I think it's Arena, moved from Oracle Arena in Oakland to the Chase Center in San Francisco. So it's just been a lot of people abandoning them. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think I see where you're coming from in that it's not necessarily a surprise that it happened. I guess it is in that it's something that you always talk about, but you don't actually expect to happen. And now that it's happening, and then, you know, as you mentioned, the run environments in Vegas are insane, which is I don't know. I just don't know how habitable MLB baseball can be played in Las Vegas. And you mentioned, I guess, other things that they could look to potentially is playing at like UNLV or something like that. Or, you know, I don't know. I just don't see how you can continue playing in Oakland, because they're obviously not going to put any resources in to make it more playable, because you're going to be leaving in a couple of years. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've spilled all of my words out on the Oakland A's at this point. And then you just threw me for another curveball, which
that was all I was going to do.
I guess that's the whole objective of the surprise part, which so that yeah, is our whole spiel just on the Oakland A's.
Now, I've heard a few things, too. I hope that they don't keep the name Athletics, because I don't think that they deserve to keep that name. You know, I think that it's, you know, I don't want to see Las Vegas Athletics, as much as I don't want to see, you know, such a storied franchise just burn. I don't think that they deserve to continue that name, you know, and all that stuff. And what you said too about kind of Oakland at the top, everyone kind of leaving Oakland at this point, that's just so shitty for the citizens of that city, you know. And you're right, though, you know, what they said on Effectively Wild, and the fact that, well, you know, at some point the politicians do just have to come in and say, no, we're not letting you do this. We're not letting you jerk us around where we would rather you leave. You know, it's kind of happened here where we live in Rhode Island with the Paw Sox moving to Worcester, you know. The Red Sox organization was really not giving the Rhode Island a fair shake. They were basically saying, look, if you want them to stay in McCoy or stay in Pawtucket, you're going to have to build a brand new stadium all out of your own pocket, and you're going to have to pay all of this money to keep it, or we're just going to go to Worcester and do this for like millions of dollars cheaper and do all that stuff. So, you know, they kind of put the politicians of Rhode Island in that situation where they couldn't make that decision. You know, they couldn't rightfully build a new stadium for the Paw Sox and then do that. And so it's just one of those things, you know, that these things happen. It's so shitty. But, you know, hopefully something there happens for Oakland. So.
Yeah. At the end of the day, I'm just hoping for anything secretive that they can salvage this. I saw one report. And once again, because it didn't come from a blue check mark, thank you, Elon Musk. I don't know if it was legit or not. I should have done more research into it beforehand, but I did see some sourcing indicate that they are trying to do, there is some movement on a potential, you know, Hail Mary bargain to buy, you know, to buy the Oakland Athletics from John J. Fisher, which once again is the best case scenario in that the A's can stay in Oakland, but it's also terrible in that this will result in John J. Fisher eventually just selling the Athletics for a profit, which is just terrible. That either way, he either gets what he wants in moving him to Vegas, or he gets what he wants in the form of billions of dollars from an ownership group trying to purchase his stake in the team. So that just about does it, I believe, on our stuff about the A's. I'm going to get into my surprise, which is back to actual on-field baseball, and it is not the fact that Mookie Betts started for the Dodgers, because, I mean, Mookie Betts is probably one of the best athletes. You know, it's like Shohei Ohtani, a couple other people probably. And then Mookie Betts, he's, you know, top three, top five level athlete in MLB. So it's not surprising to me. He played second base coming up with the Red Sox. I believe he was drafted as a shortstop. So once again, not a surprise that Mookie Betts got to play shortstop and did a pretty good job of it against the Cubs. It was the fact that it was necessary for the Dodgers, and the situation has already gotten to this point for the Dodgers. Now, we mentioned it how in our previews how we were lower on them, just because there wasn't a lot of positive movement, I guess. It was a lot of, we are going to, you know, trust the young prospects that we have, which has been working out in the interim, and it's just been, you know, we're going to try to plug and play here instead of go for the stars like we have in the past. But it led to, you know, in the past couple of years, they've had Corey Seager at shortstop, and it was fine to let him go because you had Trey Turner in the wings after trading for him. And then Trey Turner was a free agent, but it was fine to let him go because you had Gavin Lux in the wings, and it's time to finally let him get his legs out there and become a full-time shortstop. Let him finally make up to his prospect pedigree and all that. And that was well and good until he tore his ACL in spring training, which led to this new situation of Miguel Rojas, who they had just kind of picked up to be a depth piece, and then he is all of a sudden becoming the starting shortstop every day. Really struggled in his 11 games, 4 for 32, a OPS plus of negative 2. Mind you, 100 is average, so that is really not good. But yeah, so all of that happens, and then Miguel Rojas gets hurt. So you're looking to, at this point, they were going to like Luke Williams, who, if you don't know him, perfect. That is good for you. It's probably for the best that you don't know who Luke Williams is. He was a bit player, had some time off the bench for the Philadelphia Phillies, some time off the bench for the San Francisco Giants, and just recently last year played for the Miami Marlins. Not a great player, but just kind of one of those depth pieces that you look to every once in a while to fill in a spot if somebody gets hurt. And that's who they had to turn to for their shortstop situation before looking to Mookie because of just how bad it's gotten. And I think that that's just the surprise there, is that the Dodgers are a team that is prepared for everything. And even this has thrown them to such a loop to a degree that they have looked at their MVP right fielder and said, hey man, do you want to play shortstop for a little bit just until things kind of get right?
Yeah, I think my most surprising thing is that, let's remember too, he jumped in there off of paternity leave. You know, they said that he came back from paternity leave. They said that he spent the past 3 nights on a hospital bed, and I know that those hospital beds that they have for the fathers, not very comfortable. I shouldn't say the fathers, I should say the support persons.
It's about time that hospitals really thought about the men in paternity wards, maternity yeah. wards. I know nothing about childbirth. I'm sorry.
No, it's just those support person cots over there. It's literally just a foldable sofa. Not very comfortable, very difficult to sleep. Also, I'm not sure if this is how they do it over in the LA hospitals, but at least in Rhode Island, our Women and Infants here, good old Women and Infants, they do sleep-ins already with the baby, so the baby stays in the room with you the whole time, which is actually a great thing. I wouldn't have it any other way. But that means that you get the right away of needing to wake up every 2 hours, all that stuff, so all that jazz. So he went through a very crazy, amazing thing, you know, but a very crazy situation. And then they basically said, hey, now how about you come and play short, you know, and then he did it. And again, like you said, there's no real surprise that he did well because he's Mookie Betts, you know, like he's bowled 300, you know, like he's an amazing athlete. Excels at everything that he does and all that stuff. And like you said, he did come up playing kind of middle infield, so surely he can kind of just translate it there. But it was absolutely surprising, just the whole sort of situation. And then, as you're saying too, like, it is surprising that even though we did kind of predict this, you know, it's still surprising to think that they're just in such a terrible situation with all of this, and that we don't even know, like, if Miguel Rojas comes back and he's not hurt, like you were saying, he's just was playing terribly this year. I didn't know it was that bad, but he's just playing terribly this year to the point where, can you even trust that at all? So now, where are you going to get any innings? Maybe I've heard some things floating around about Tim Anderson getting traded and stuff like that, but you're going to have to really scrape some prospects up and get players of that caliber if you want to have someone that is going to be your shortstop. So Dodgers always figure this shit out, so I'm sure that they will. I'm sure that they'll find some, you know, one of the best shortstops in the league and then put them in and slot them in. But it is surprising how it's gotten to this part.
Yeah, there is a 28-year-old backup shortstop in like Tulsa playing for the Tulsa Drillers in the Dodgers system that is prepared to have an 840 OPS by the time July rolls around as their starting option. So once again, it is something that I am positive the Dodgers will be fine about, and they're going to still end up being good because, once again, they have been good enough in the regular season to earn the benefit of the doubt for this. And it just, you know, it feels like when looking at this roster, it's the meme of the like drawing of Jesus, and the guy that's like covered in blood and everything is like, give me harder battles. And the drawing of Jesus is just like, what the hell, man? Because you look at this roster and it's like they're just trying to play baseball on hard mode. They made some good savvy signings. They still have their superstars, but it's just, like I said, Miguel Rojas, prospects like Miguel Vargas and James Outman. The bench is Clay Thompson's brother, Jason Hayward, who's been terrible for the past 7 years, and they're having him be the guy against righties off the bench, you know.
Did you see him, how he just completely forgot how to play outfield too?
I saw him on the Brandon Nimmo three base error to start off Clayton Kershaw's night. But yeah, and it's just something that even then with the pitching, you know, they're looking at Shelby Miller to be like a guy out of the bullpen. It dating back to people like Yency Almonte, turning him into something good. It's insane how the Dodgers do this, and it's insane how they keep doing this. And once again, they're going to keep being tested. So I wonder how much we're going to see of Mookie at shortstop in the future, especially when Miguel Rojas comes back. I can see it continuing to happen because, like I said, their outfield is still pretty solid and they could use a boost on the infield. So if Miguel Rojas is struggling, you could see it happen. But I think that just about does it for our first, I guess, the inaugural segment of Triple Play, which leads right into our Mets time. Which is, I timed that perfectly because just as I said that, Brandon Nimmo grounded out to Brandon Crawford to end the game for a 5-4 win for the San Francisco Giants, wrapping up the Mets' 10-game West Coast road trip at a 7-3 clip. Still, you know, you couldn't have asked for any more. I believe when we did our predictions for how these 7 games against the Dodgers were going to go, you said 5-2, I said 4-3. One of us is correct. I won't get into it, but you can do the math when you look at the Mets schedule. But yeah, I still think that as far as all is said and done, it's about as well as you could ask for this West Coast road trip to go, given what has been happening with the pitching. And we'll talk a little bit about the Max Scherzer ejection and suspension while looking forward. But yeah. I think overall a pretty damn solid week for Mets baseball.
Yeah, you know, I think that this was a really solid week. I think that in classic, you know, Mets situations, it's very disappointing to see them, you know, lose the last two. But you're also, you know, completely right. The pitching has been weary. You know, it's been very interesting the past 2 days. We haven't really gotten much from our starters at all. And our relief pitchers have really stepped up, but you know, when it comes to relief pitchers needing to step up, then that means that they're going to need to pitch multiple days. And one thing that I've heard, they keep mentioning it on TV, is that Buck Showalter is really good about not letting players, relief pitchers in particular, obviously pitch back-to-back days. You know, he did it the least last year. And I'm appreciative of that because I think that we're lucky enough in the situation where I think we have more than enough reliable arms in the pen, that we can afford to do things like that. But it's just one of those things that it gets really tough on them and whatnot. So I think with all things considered, if you told me that, you know, you were going to get nothing out of your starting pitching, and then you were going to go, like you said, we went 7-3. You know, you go 7-3 on this road trip. I think that's a pretty good thing, especially in the past with how the West Coast has treated us. It's just a hard place to travel and then go and play. So,
yeah, and it is just something in general with West Coast road trips that is tough. You're going to a place completely outside of your typical, you know, sleeping patterns and just living patterns in general. And typically it's even harder because the West Coast road trip consisted typically of the Oakland A's, who, as we mentioned, once upon a time were really good pretty recently, and then you're facing the Dodgers and Giants, who are all solid teams. Sometimes you get the Padres in there, who more recently have been good, but just in general are fine. It's just kind of it's kind of, you know, just a symptom or a easy way to go like 4-6 on a 10-game road trip, and they were able to go 7-3. And when you're not getting super duper impressive performances out of your starting pitching, that is really huge, and it's indicative of an offense that is kind of starting to pick everything up. You know, I mean, Pete Alonso is exactly at a one dot on the OPS, 1,000 OPS. This is obviously not including today's game, in which I believe he either went 0-for or only had a hit, but still has just been on an absolute tear this year. Francisco Lindor hasn't been getting too many hits, but whenever he does, he's hitting them for extra bases, you know, slugging 463 on the season. They finally called up Brett Beatty and Francisco Alvarez and are starting to let him get a little bit more time there. They're starting to start him a little bit more often. Beatty, you can tell, is starting to get into a bit more of a rhythm. And Francisco Alvarez has struggled a little bit, but is putting together some better ABs and did hit his first home run of the season this year, which is exciting. So, yeah, I think all in all, you're starting to see the offense heat up, which is a very good thing. This is all, haven't even mentioned Brandon Nimmo yet, who's been on an absolute tear to start this season off with another one dot at the time of recording. Once again, not including tonight's game, a 1,005 OPS.
Yeah, no, Nimmo has been insane. But, you know, I think those are even the easy things to talk about. I do want to talk a little bit about Alvarez, you know. I think a lot's been said about his struggles coming up. He has really looked kind of overmatched, you know, as we talk about it. He hit a homer, you know, just, you know, 30 minutes ago, and it was off of a side armor. So, and it was also off of a pitch that was like 6 inches out of the zone. So that's beautiful. But anyways, you know, I think that not enough can be said about the fact that he, you know, comes up in a situation where we really needed another catcher to kind of come out, because Nito's been, honestly, I can't even say that it's been surprising how bad he's been, because he's even joked about it himself. You know, he can't hit. He doesn't know how to hit a baseball, I don't think. You know, he's even said it last year where someone was asking him about like tips on hitting, or like how do you hit a certain guy, and he's like, if you know, tell me, you know, because like I just can't do it. So I, you know, he needed to come up in a situation where we needed a jolt, we needed an offensive person, but we also needed a catcher, one of the, obviously the hardest positions to kind of come up and compete at. So, apparently he's been really, really focused on getting kind of his game caught up in that regard. So I think that obviously it's really nerving to see him struggle at the bat. But I do think that those things will pick up eventually. Once he gets more used to seeing major league pitching, and once he gets more used to catching a major league roster, I do think that, you know, this it's going to come out at the end of this. The Mets are going to be in a really interesting situation when Omar Narvaez gets back. I'm really intrigued by that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think at that point, when Narvaez does come back, I don't see how you can send him down. It's going to be tough because it's at that point, how do you get consistent ABs in there? I think you would consider going to three catchers because that would allow you to DH him. I think the reason why a lot of people are saying, you know, just DH him whenever you play Nito at catcher, it's tough because they only carry two catchers. So if anything happens to Nito, then they have to put in Alvarez there and you forfeit the DH. And, you know, they have been playing NL baseball with the pitcher batting for a while now, but that's not what you want to be in, especially with how especially with how Buck Showalter likes to use his bench. So I don't know, it is one of those situations where this is why, and I'm a big proponent of going real slow with catchers, because I mean, we had the whole thing with Adley Rutschman being given the keys and really taking off last year, but also Adley Rutschman's 25. He was a full-time starting catcher in college and then got ample time in the minors to really get used to it. And he was catching a team that had playoff aspirations, but didn't have like these World Series aspirations that the Mets have with, you know, an older rotation that knows what they want out of a catcher. So it's one of those things where Alvarez is a 21-year-old kid coming up, and now he has to catch Max Scherzer and, you know, these older veteran pitchers that are looking for a chance to get their team to the World Series. And it's just a tough situation if you want to expect a lot of playing time. So I am also curious as to what's going to happen when Narvaez comes back. It is a pretty lengthy injury, so I don't think we're going to see it for another month or two. But yeah, we mentioned the pitching, and for the next week, it's going to be a little light. As we mentioned, the injuries to Carlos Carrasco, obviously this happened before the season, but the injuries to guys like Jose Quintana have really thinned out this rotation to the point that now Joey Lucchese, who pitched wonderful, first Mets starter to get into the seventh inning, pitched seven innings of great ball a couple days ago to get the win in San Francisco. But Max Scherzer, once again, got his suspension. He is not appealing it because it is being arbitrated by MLB, and he just didn't feel that that was going to be something that he was going to win, which I understand where he's coming from. It's just tough because it's a situation where I don't think that he was really doing anything. Might have been more to his reaction to getting checked, but he mentioned it before, and he went over the whole situation, and he got checked in the third, knew he was going to get checked in the fourth, so he just said, you know, I'd be a real idiot, and I don't think that Max Scherzer is a real idiot to try to doctor his stuff again before going out for the fourth inning. So I tend to come out on Max Scherzer's side. The umpires that ejected him, Phil Cuzzi, have been around for all three ejections due to sticky stuff, and then Dan Bellini was the guy that was eyeing down Madison Bumgarner before ejecting him for the sticky stuff. So I have my doubts. But regardless of what happens, this is going to be a tough time for the next 10 days, especially because they can't go into the roster to get that 26th man, because when you are suspended, they can't replace your spot in the roster. So it is definitely going to be tough.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I do agree with you. You know, I think it's tough. Like, obviously, you know, I don't always want to side with the people that have gotten suspended and stuff like that. But this is really a situation where I think, you know, one of the bigger takes that has come out of this is, why the hell are we suspending people off of something literally subjective? You know, like there isn't a go-to scale on any of this. It's just based off of the training of the umpires. And again, we've had one umpire who has thrown people out. Now, either that means that the rest of the umpires don't know what sticky stuff is, you know, and they don't know how to do this, or this umpire just really likes to pick fights. And that's also not fair to kind of put on Cuzzy, you know, but it does beg the question, like, if this has only happened three times and all three times have been him, what is he seeing that no one else is seeing, you know? Yeah. Is he like a sticky stuff savant, you know what I mean? Like, I don't understand what's going on here. And also, like, if you know that this was nothing but rosin, you know, where does any of that go? And it all goes back to, Jerry Blevins put this perfectly, it all goes back to just fix the freaking baseball, you know? Just, we already have models that work, like the Japan baseball and stuff. We already have models that work. Just fix it. Just do something to the baseball so people don't feel like they have to, you know what I mean? And then, like, if you fix the baseball, then you can just eliminate rosin, and you can just eliminate all these other things, so that now, if you have, you know, kind of stickiness and all those things, then you know that it's something that is illegal, you know, so then you can objectively state that that person is cheating, something along those lines, you know. I've gotten a lot of people asking me in kind of, like, gotcha ways, like, oh, how do you feel about Max Scherzer, you know, and it's, like, so frustrating, because I don't feel like he is in the wrong in this in the slightest bit. I feel like he's really gotten fucked over by this situation and this system that MLB has arbitrarily put on everyone to say, yep, hey, you know, you can use this rosin, but don't use too much of it, you know, and whatnot. And so it's just one of those things where it's like, I just don't understand how you can blame the players on this for something, like I said, so subjective. You really have to find a middle ground, and MLB just doesn't seem to want to do that.
Yeah, and regardless, it is going to be a tough week for them upcoming, with a starting rotation of David Peterson, Tyler McGill, Kodai Senga, Joey Lucchese, and ? Maybe you get Tommy Hunter in there to try to give you a little bit of length. Maybe you just go straight up bullpen game. Some guy is the bulk guy, like I said, maybe Tommy Hunter. There is an open spot on Tuesday, I believe, which is when Scherzer's spot in the rotation would come up, which is a good thing that it is the Nationals, so you can kind of get away with doing like a bulk bullpen game. But looking ahead, 3 against the Nationals, 4 against the Braves, all 7 at home. And I think that, once again, it's going to be a pretty easy thing against the Nationals. And then the first real NL East test in the Braves. This was a very intense, exciting back and forth last year, and it's looking like it's going to be very intense and exciting now. Both teams are 14-9 after the Braves also lost to the Astros today. So I think it's going to be very exciting. Chris, what are your thoughts? I mean, prediction for the upcoming 7 games?
I think you have to hope for, I think your best case scenario is a 4-3. I think what is probably more realistic is a 3-4 stretch. I'm going to go on the side of, you know, optimistic, and I think that we're going to figure something out. I think we'll be able to, you know, I'm hoping that we'll be able to sweep the Nationals and then take one from the Braves for a 4-3 here. But I don't know. I mean, what's your feeling? I really don't know how to gauge this next week.
I'm looking to 3-4. I think you split with Atlanta and take 2 of 3 from the Nationals. My take is that you're going to take 2 of 3 from the Nationals, but that loss is not going to be the game that has the open spot that you're either going to be throwing a AAA guy or a bulk game. I have a feeling they win that and then win one of the other two games. I mean, lose one of the other two games that you expect them to win. That's just how these series with the Nationals go.
It's how the Mets go, yeah.
Yeah, the Nationals are a terrible team, but they have had annoying games with them, especially last year when they were still a really terrible team. But yeah, that Braves series, looking really forward to it. One of those that you wish you had Max there, you wish you had Justin Verlander there, but I think that they can make do and at least split. And speaking of Justin Verlander, he pitched a sim game today, about 43 pitches, I believe, is set for a rehab start on Friday, which would line him up to make his season debut on either Wednesday or Thursday against the Tigers. That'll be exciting. I don't know if there's still any real connection with him to Detroit. I guess Miggy's still there, so there's that. But it feels like that team is a shell of itself, what it was in the early 2010s when both Scherzer and JV were there. And that's another thing, is that this will be Scherzer and JV's, probably first time back-to-back in the rotation in Detroit, where they were back-to-back in the rotation. I don't know if they were ever back-to-back. I'll have to consult that, but... yeah, so I think that that'll be exciting, and it is they're finally starting to get closer to the Mets that you're going to hopefully see in October. I'll be really curious to see what Justin Verlander looks like when he comes back.
Yeah, get Anibal Sanchez over there, and they can really make it a reunion.
What's Rick Porcello doing?
Yeah, it'll be. Yeah, well, probably not. Probably just staring at a Cy Young Award. I do agree. You know, I think that I'm very intrigued to see Verlander. You know, I hate to put it this way, but what a good draw for him to kind of come back. You gotta wonder if his AAA battle is gonna be harder than his major league battle.
It might be.
I kid with that. But you know, I don't really know who Detroit's throwing out there to kind of make it difficult on non-Verlander, but. It'll be interesting. You know, like I said, the Mets are 14-9, and we've had not great games from Max, you know, and we haven't had Quintana. Senga's been kind of up and down. I still think Senga's actually been really good. You know, I know that his kind of numbers are struggling, but I think once he kind of figures out his control a little bit better, which will come, I believe, then, you know, he's going to kind of go off like a rocket or whatever. But yeah, like you're saying, you know, losing Carrasco, having to rely on McGill and Peterson, which isn't always the worst thing in the world. At least they're decent enough arms, you know, even Jose Buto and, like you said, Joey Lucchesi, and then we're here 14-9. That's really cool. So the Mets kind of really, pushed it, and then hopefully Verlander can kind of take us on, and then we have Verlander and Max, and things start looking a little bit normal. So
yeah. I think you said it well, that there hasn't been a ton other than, like, obviously Pete and Nemo really going off that you look at and be like, you know what, this is looking really, really good. And they're still 14-9, which is a good sign. When you can win when you're not doing great, I think that's always a good sign. Chris, really, really quick before we get out, do you want to remember some guys?
Yeah.
All right.
Were you telling me to start that off? Or?
Yeah.
keeping up with the Oakland Athletics theme, DJ, so you can't get out of this one. I am going to go with everyone's favorite side armor, Chad Bradford. Chad Bradford made no All-Star appearances, and he was kind of just like a good pitcher. Like, he wasn't great, you know, was kind of just like a good pitcher, but he had a really iconic delivery. Was always fun. He was definitely the first like submariner that I knew of. I know that there's obviously more out there, but he was definitely one of the first submariners that I knew of. And I knew him mostly obviously from his New York Metropolitan days. He did serve 1 year in the Mets in 06, and then he moved on to Baltimore for the next 2 years, which is where I knew him a lot for. I feel like he had some kind of memorable moments in Baltimore. But I just remember he was kind of like a knuckle scraper sidearm, submariner. Like, he really got down there. And just a fun little quirkiness. I feel like you don't get many quirky guys in the MLB with their deliveries and stuff. I think like Nestor Cortez is probably the most quirkiness that you get. And he can't even really do his quirky stuff anymore. So,
well, I mean, there is Tyler Rogers.
I know that there are like submariners and there are stuff like that, but you don't really get like, it's just like saying like there's really no knuckleballs anymore. You know, it's like there's just no guys that have that type of thing where maybe their stuff isn't that good, so they have to kind of deceive you in other ways. And it's just an interesting perspective. Again, he really wasn't that great when you look at his numbers. He really wasn't. But I wanted to pick a guy that was in Moneyball, so I picked Chad Bradford.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. He did have a great chapter in Moneyball from what I remember. Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I know of Chad Bradford and looking at him, I'm going to give him a little bit more credit than you did. I think that was actually a pretty good reliever. You know, nothing too special off the page, but otherwise just a really, really solid guy that you could rely on for a low threes, high twos ERA, which I think is exactly what you can ask for a reliever, especially a guy that doesn't have that electric stuff. But yeah, I mean, as far as I'm concerned with him, that is the one thing that I know him for, is being that submariner guy and having a great chapter about him in Moneyball. Shout out Michael Lewis. Yeah, I think that he was one of those guys that was trying to really break in as, you know, just a regular pitcher, and then it just wasn't working. So it was one of those, hey, why don't you try this? And then gave it a shot, was really, really good at it. And all of a sudden was, you know, being not the closer, but the, you know, kind of the come in and shut things down before it got to Billy Koch, I want to say, was the closer of those Moneyball Oakland A's teams. Let me see right now. Oh, God, it's not coming up.
I got it up.
Oh, it was Jason Isringhausen. Well, Jason Isringhausen on the first Moneyball team, and I believe that the team that the book was always based on was Billy Koch, because they had lost Isringhausen, Damon, Giambi, all that, and then this was the season. So I was indeed correct. Real brain genius here with the Billy Koch pull. But that is not my guy to remember. My guy to remember is a classic all strikeouts, all homers guy, zero-time All-Star Mark Reynolds. Just an amazing look at a player. If you want to see a guy that got into baseball 10 years too early, it's Mark Reynolds. Because, I mean, he put up some pretty impressive strikeout numbers, 204, 223, and 211 in a three-year span. But also that stuff that, like, you look at, like, Giancarlo Stanton putting up those numbers and it's like, yeah, that's fine. It's whatever. I'm gonna vamp on him for a little bit and then try to look at the strikeout leaders for the last couple of years, because he'd probably fit right in terms of how often he struck out, but also just a prolific power hitter. And just somebody that you could look to, especially in his Arizona Diamondbacks days, for, you know, just 35, 40 homers a year. Just a really, really fun guy that is, you know, I think the main guy of this era that was the true three true outcomes guy was Adam Dunn. And maybe he didn't, maybe Mac Reynolds didn't walk enough to really get the three true outcomes guy part of it. But, you know, just a really prototypical hitter of somebody that would have really fit in like 2019.
Yeah, no, it's really fun. He actually was in the league in 2019. But as a 35-year-old, so I do love that he had a few. He has a few years in Colorado. I love to see, you know, homer guys just go to Colorado. It's one of my favorite things in the world to kind of just see people that team, because that's another team who could have totally mentioned them with the A's and everything. That's another team that just is wanderless, you know. And to kind of see people just go over there to hit bombs is beautiful. But yeah, this is fun. Stuck at 298 home runs. I think he needs to kind of Bernie Mac this and get in the league and just hit two more. He can do two more, you know.
I don't know. The whole thing about the Bernie Mac movie was that he couldn't come back and get the three hits.
Come on. You can give him, you know, he's 39. Give him, you know, rest of the season. Let him play in Colorado. Let him go on the A's. What the hell, you know? He might be like player in the
That's
A's.
Not going to be really conducive for hitting home runs, but you're right. He probably would bat like third for the A's.
Yeah. But hey, they do have away games. You know, you play 80 away. So.
Fair. 81 away.
I just was saying a number.
But yeah, so I was looking into it, and yes, he still would have been a league leader in strikeouts for most seasons, but he would not have been alone in the 200 strikeout club. You look at 2022, there was only one guy in the 200 strikeout club, Kyle Schwarber. 2021, Joey Gallo and Matt Chapman. Some surprising names. I didn't like peg Matt Chapman as a strikes out 202 times in a season guy. And then, you know, to 2019, surprisingly, no 200 strikeout guys in 2019. But 2018 is the last season I'll go to for the sake of this argument. Yoan Moncada, Giancarlo Stanton, and Joey Gallo all struck out over 200 times, with Moncada leading with 217. So yeah, Mark Reynolds' 223 would still lead. I believe that is the all-time record in a single season for strikeouts. So yeah, I mean, even in that season, he had an 892 OPS with 44 home runs. So just, you know, like we said earlier in the Remember Some Guys, the whole part of Remember Some Guys is just guys that had one thing that you really, really remember them for. You remember Chad Bradford as the Submariner guy that threw for your favorite team for a year. You remember Mark Reynolds as the guy that struck out all the time but also hit a ton of bombs. And I feel like guys like Mark Reynolds are like the perfect encapsulation of what we're kind of going after with this segment.
Yeah. One last thing on Mark Reynolds, and you can never really trust the nickname section in Baseball Reference. Nicknames are Mega Mark, Sheriff of Swattingham, Skeletor, or Forrest Gump. I don't understand any of those, but I'm happy that he had those nicknames.
Those are some white-ass nicknames.
Come on, though. Sheriff of Swattingham?
Skeletor? That one's pretty dope.
Skeletor is a baller nickname.
I would love to know the background behind Skeletor.
Or Forrest Gump.
I mean, he didn't do a lot of walking, and you don't really run on home run jogs.
None of it makes any sense. But
he did have 24 steals. He did have 24 steals in that 223 strikeout season, so.
Good for Mega Mark.
Yeah, maybe there's that. Once again, we got into the like and subscribe part of this at the end of the podcast. But please do that.
Sorry, that year was 44 home runs and 24 stolen bases?
Yes.
That's sick.
He's elite. But yeah, once again, getting into the like, give us 5 stars, way late. Follow Ball 5 Pod, whatever. Chris, do you have any parting thoughts?
No, just sorry for Oakland, but hey. Revel in the screw this team. I don't know what you do. I don't know if you say screw this team, I'm not giving you any money, or say fuck this, I'm going to every Oakland A's game I can. I don't know what you do.
I think you go the other route, but hey, if anybody that likes the Oakland A's and lives in Oakland would like to give us a shout out and talk to us, I'd love to. But yeah, we hope you enjoy, and we hope that you tune in next week.
Yep. Bye, everyone.